Hi, I'm Phelan Johnson.
And I'm Leah Simone Bowen, and we look at history a bit differently. Have you ever wondered how hundreds of wild horses came to inhabit an island in the Atlantic Ocean?
Or what Lord of the Rings and a small town in Manitoba have in common? Or the burning question, did Canada invent the teen drama?
The Secret Life of Canada is a podcast about the country you know and the stories you don't. New episodes available now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Coming up on The Cost of Living.
How many of you have any idea what Visa is? Where it's headquartered, how it's structured, who owns it, who sets the rules, how the pricing works? And of course, almost everyone's hand goes down.
Everyone knows what a credit card is. You may have one in your pocket right now. But what do credit card companies really do? That's more of a mystery. Hi, I'm Paul Havershood. Welcome to The Cost of Living. When you tap your credit card, it's like flipping on a light switch. It works and you don't really think much about it. But if someone asked you, what is Visa? Could you tell them? Also today, when you think about nostalgia, what comes to mind? Poodle skirts, maybe the Guess Who. For a younger generation, it's Pokemon. Those little Japanese anime monsters may not feel that old, but to a 90s kid, that's childhood. And that nostalgia is turning into real money. Up first, you know what would be a fun surprise? If a big project came in under budget. But that is not the way things usually go. Pipelines, hydro dams, hospitals. Why do so many big projects always seem to get the costs so wrong? Think about the last big thing that was built where you live. A hospital, an arena, a transit line. Was it on time and on budget? Ha, you say?
I never trust the timelines that they give anymore.
They've been saying for a while now, oh, we're going to open by so-and-so. By this point, I wouldn't even believe them if they said we're going to open by 2030.
It's pretty much a joke at this point.
They're talking about Ottawa's new transit line. It's 2 years behind schedule and will cost more than promised. And it has a lot of company. Many of the big projects that get built in this country blow by their timelines and cost estimates. Look at the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion. Oil is about to start flowing soon, and the price tag is now $34 billion. That, Jennifer Keane, is a big number.
I honestly can't even really wrap my head around how much money that is, especially when you consider that the original estimate for the project was around $7.5 billion.
So we're looking at something like $25 billion more dollars. And there are cost overruns, but this is a cost overrun.
Yeah, it's a big one. And Chris Bloomer has been watching it unfold for the last dozen years. He's the former head of the Canadian Energy Pipelines Association. He says in the last 6 years, ever since the federal government bought it, TMX has had to deal with floods, supply chain issues, inflation, and of course, a pandemic.
And that affected labor supply, labor cost, you know, delays in getting equipment. And the restrictions led to terrific inefficiencies, and the cost started ballooning with respect to that.
Then there were Indigenous consultations and environmental requirements. Just for example, Paul, 3 years ago, crews were clearing some land near Burnaby in BC. They'd cut down some trees.
And in one of those trees was a hummingbird nest, and there were people out there, environmentalists and so on, saw the hummingbird nest, and it was within migrating season. So they had to shut down that activity on the pipeline at that point until the season was over. And that alone is estimated to cost $100 million.
That's a chunk of change. I mean, all those crews, they just had to wait for like a while.
Yeah, 4 months, because under the Migratory Bird Act, you cannot disturb the nest of a a migrating bird, which this hummingbird was. So they had to wait till the hummingbirds flew away. But they also, they had to move anthills. They relocated 150,000 frogs.
Okay, so they're out there, they're scooping up frogs. I mean, this is labor intensive. And of course, we know that there's a labor crunch, labor costs went up. TMX had to deal with a lot of issues. But this isn't just a TMX thing. If you step back, look at mega projects in general, they seem to go over budget all the time.
And you can point to these projects in just about every part of the country.
I'll go from east to west. So the furthest east, Muskrat Falls in Newfoundland, is a dam project that had a major cost overrun.
Maddie Simiatiki is the director of the Infrastructure Institute at the University of Toronto.
Here in Ontario, we have the Eglinton Crosstown, which is now significantly delayed.
He says projects like this going over budget, it's been happening for decades.
We have been experiencing cost overruns on projects from coast to coast to coast. It's one of the few things that binds this entire country together.
So, hockey, donuts, cost overruns.
But it's not just a Canadian problem. A research paper from about 15 years ago looked at a sample of 258 transportation infrastructure projects around the world and found that 9 out of 10 finished late and cost more than originally proposed.
Okay, that's not great. But I also find it a bit comforting that this isn't just something that happens in Canada. Still, we see it so much. Why is this just the way of things?
Well, today, Maddie says these mega projects, they're just so technical. They're like IT projects wrapped in steel. They're often built in crowded cities, if you think about transit projects, or they're built in tough terrain like TMX. But that only really explains why they're expensive and hard to do.
Yeah, it doesn't really get to why they cost so much more than it was originally thought they would cost.
That comes down to psychology and human nature and what Maddie calls the optimism bias.
Humans tend to be optimistic. We tend to be over-optimistic about our own abilities and our skill, and also that all of the luck that you need for a project, like weather, is going to go your way. And so when those biases come to fruition on big projects, then you tend to see overruns happen.
Maddie says planners underestimate the obstacles and they overestimate their ability to get things done. If you look at Muskrat Falls, the hydroelectric dam in Labrador, the estimated cost for that project was $7.4 billion. The final cost was nearly twice that much.
Yeah, Muskrat Falls turned into a big financial problem for the provincial government.
The federal government had to step in with billions in loans, and they held an inquiry to find out what had gone so wrong. Among other things, they found that the estimates were overly optimistic.
Okay, but if we know this is a problem, why does it keep happening?
Well, there's a lot of salesmanship involved in getting these big projects off the ground. Politicians need to convince voters that they're a good idea. Contractors need to convince governments to pick them. So the job, Maddie says, often goes to whoever tells the best story.
And that can sometimes mean underestimating the cost of a project to get your own project prioritized, or suggesting that it can go faster or more efficiently than perhaps it can because you want it to rise to the top and get selected.
The guru of mega projects is an Oxford professor named Bent Flubier. He calls this strategic misrepresentation.
Strategic misrepresentation. That is a heck of a euphemism.
He's not the guru of mega projects for nothing. It really is. But we aren't just talking about big public projects, right? Private projects also run into these same issues. It's just that we pay more attention to public projects because they're spending public money, and we judge governments based on their success or failure. When these projects blow past their deadlines and their budgets time and again,
I think it poses a real risk. It starts to pick at the fabric of how we think of government, that we empower government to make decisions and then those governments to spend public money on critical projects that are going to make our communities better. And when these projects go over budget and when they're late over and over again, it really starts to tear at that fabric.
So this is something that makes us more cynical, like not just about these big projects, but it like shakes our faith in government in general. Is there a way to make this better?
The answer, at least in part, Maddie says, is to spend more time on planning and to get rid of that optimism bias.
I would argue that what we need is an evidence-based, a bias towards evidence, that we should be using our past experiences of not just how much the cost overrun was, but how much it cost per kilometer of subway, for example, or how much it cost per kilometer of road, and using that to then inform what we would expect the future cost to be. Sometimes we do that and use past experience, and other times the estimates for these numbers are very politically motivated.
Hey, I'm all for optimism, but just hear me out here. What if we had more of a pessimism bias?
Ah, you would under-promise and over-deliver.
Well, you would, but that has definitely not happened with something like Trans Mountain.
No, and that bill is coming due. The federal government says it wants to sell the pipeline, but experts are saying they will probably have to eat some of the costs, maybe as much as half the cost.
And those costs ultimately come back on us.
You know it.
Thanks, Jen.
You're welcome.
On your radio and by podcast, this is The Cost of Living. I'm Paul Habershrood. Depending on your age, nostalgia may hit when you see James Dean or tie-dye shirts, Bananarama. Now, for some, the peak of nostalgia is Pokemon cards. If you were a kid in the late 90s, those little Japanese anime monsters were everything. And now, those kids are grown up. They have more money than just an allowance. And Philip Dross says the tug of nostalgia makes Pokemon good business.
I wanna be the very best, like no one ever was.
If that song makes you want to sit in front of the TV with a bowl of Lucky Charms, you're not alone. Daniel Dowse was 6 when Pokemon cards came to Canada in the late 90s.
I remember going to the convenience store just around the corner and buying packs of cards. You know, in hindsight, could have made some serious money buying sealed product back then, but the joy was just ripping the cards and having fun trading at school and, you know, sometimes getting the better deal.
As a teen, Daniel lost interest in Pokemon cards and stopped collecting. But at 30, he's back at it.
Beautiful set. Like, these are cards that personally I would consider putting on a wall.
He keeps his most precious cards in a case that looks like it could be bulletproof.
And then a couple of other ones here that are just kind of, you know, a bit more rare from Japan.
And that's because they're more valuable than you think.
Probably close to $10,000, I'd say, just in this case alone.
Pokemon cards are having a moment. Searches on eBay Canada for Pokemon have increased by more than 160% in the last 5 years. Companies that deal in trading cards have also seen a spike in business. Jeff Follett works at 401 Games in Toronto. He says during the pandemic, when people were stuck at home, they started dusting off their old decks.
Yeah, I mean, we have a fair amount of people that go through and find their own collections in closets and end up wanting to sell some of the cards that they think are worth money. And we also get people that then find that their interest in the hobby is reinvigorated upon finding their old collections and come in to also purchase more cards from us as well.
There are dozens of online forums where people talk about the money they spend collecting. And it can be a lot. This year, someone dropped $26,000 on a single card. What's pulling people back into the Pokemon vortex? It actually has a name. It's called the 30-year nostalgia cycle.
So we have a time in our lives when we enjoy playing with things, when we have carefree time, when we're having the most fun of our lives.
Sarah Wilner teaches marketing at Wilfrid Laurier University.
And as we get older, we hearken back to those times. And by the time we're an adult, we start thinking back when things are stressful, as they are very much so now in the world, to the times that we enjoyed the most. And this is also the time that we tend to have the greatest buying power. And often for many people, it's the time when they start their own families and they start thinking, gee, what do I want my kids to have that I got to experience when I was that age?
We still like the things we liked as kids. And it's not just Pokemon. Fanny packs are back. So is the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Now, if you do have a stash of old Pokemon cards you want to sell, Jeff Follett says you better have played with them gently as a kid.
That can really dictate the value of them, especially for these older cards. People are really looking for items that are in the best condition.
So if that shadowless Pikachu has been through the wash, or your little sister scribbled on your first edition Charizard, you probably can't sell them for much. But at least you still got them, right? And didn't make the same mistake as Daniel Doust.
You mentioned you did end up selling your cards, maybe not getting the better deal.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. 13, 14 years old when I was too cool for Pokemon. Local flea market, $50 in my pocket. I was happy, but I'm sad about it now, trust me.
For the cost of living, I'm Philip Drost.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
On your radio and by podcast, this is The Cost of Living. I'm Paul Havershrood. Pat Nichols first went traveling on his own 6 years ago. He went backpacking in Europe on a shoestring, wound up in Prague, and figured he had enough in the budget to splash out a little.
I was out with just some random people I met from the hostel. I don't know, it was kind of the end of the trip, so we figured we'd just go to a nightclub and, you know, have a bit of a more bougie night out than usually when you're backpacking.
So they go to a club. They get a little booth in the back with bottle service. They were told it would cost a couple hundred bucks Canadian.
They ended up charging me euros anyways, which, you know, at that time it was like $1.6 per euro. So yeah, it ended up being about $700.
And of course, he didn't have $700 on him.
I mean, if you've ever been to Prague, a great city, but if you've ever dealt with nightclub security at Prague or bar security, they're all very stocky, very built dudes. They scare the hell out of me, and I'm 6'7". So, I don't know. I really don't know how it would have went.
So, Pat pulled out his Visa card, paid the bill, and he got the heck out of there. Like the commercial says, Visa, it's everywhere you want to be. Almost anywhere in the world, you can swipe a little piece of plastic and people will just give you stuff. It's like magic. But have you ever stopped and thought, what is Visa? The founder of Visa was a guy named Dee Hawk. He'd do this thing when he gave a talk. He'd hold a Visa card above his head and ask, who knows what this is? Everyone would put up their hand, and then he'd say,
how many of you have any idea where it's headquartered, how it's structured, who owns it, who sets the rules, how the pricing works? And of course, almost everyone's hand goes down.
David Stearns wrote about the history of Visa in his book, Electronic Value Exchange. Today, Visa is the 12th most valuable company in the world. And yet, it doesn't make anything. It doesn't sell anything. It doesn't even issue cards. The banks do that. So then Visa is what exactly?
Visa is fundamentally an organizational structure and a set of operating regulations that allow a whole bunch of competing banks, financial institutions, to come together and cooperate just enough to facilitate a ubiquitous payment system that none of those individual banks could have built on their own.
How can an organizational structure be worth $500 billion? it comes down to relationships. Visa has spent 50 years establishing relationships with more than 14,000 banks and financial institutions around the world. And that wasn't easy. Banks are competitive. But DeHawk convinced them.
By cooperating, they can kind of bake a larger cooperative pie and enjoy their slice of that pie. And that slice will be much bigger than a pie that they could have baked individually by themselves.
Visa's origins go back to 1958. At that time, banks were trying to figure out how to get credit cards off the ground. But stores didn't trust them, and customers didn't know what they were. So Bank of America did something now called the drop. It mailed 60,000 credit cards, unsolicited, to households in Fresno, California. Then it pumped money into advertising to teach people how to use them. The Bank AmeriCard, it took off. Other banks started to offer it, but Bank of America was making most of the money. And of course, the other banks, they did not like this. The bigger the card got, the more problems it ran into.
The whole system was about to fall apart in 1968. This is when DeHawk, who at that point was just running a Bank AmeriCard program at a bank in Seattle, stood up and said, "Hey, I have an idea."
He realized that banks were never going to play nice together. So he came up with the thing that made Visa happen.
He's a kind of interesting dude. He was very much enamored with the way natural systems work and that there's nobody in charge, yet somehow an ecosystem can just thrive and be, you know, like create massive amounts of life and all kinds of variety. And so he said, well, what if we created an organization that was more like a natural system, more like an ecosystem than a traditional command and control business?
So DeHawk convinced a bunch of bank CEOs to turn things over to him. And he pitched a different kind of corporate structure. Visa became a for-profit, non-stock membership association. It meant the member banks owned Visa, but Visa ran things. And if Visa made money, they all shared in the profits.
They've created a structure where these competitors can cooperate, right? Citibank, you know, always wanted to create their own card network, and they tried in the 70s that would be worldwide. But like, it's just impossible for that one bank to have done that in the 1970s. It was much more realistic if all the banks cooperated to create that ubiquity where you could just use your card anywhere.
Part of why Visa can be used anywhere is because it delegates most of the work. The banks issue the cards to customers, and they sign up merchants. Visa is just the middleman that connects the money. It runs 6 data centers around the world. That's where the information gets sent when you tap your card, and then your transaction is accepted or declined.
You know, Visa, I think, runs, last time I calculated out, there were something like 4,000 transactions a second, bursting upwards towards 10,000 transactions a second when they're at kind of higher load.
That works out to hundreds of millions of transactions a day. And on each one of them, merchants pay an interchange fee. It's around 1%. Most of that money goes to the banks, and then they kick back most of it to cardholders in the form of rewards. Where banks make money is when you don't pay off your card at the end of the month. That's when your credit turns into a loan. And of course, they ding you for that interest payment. As for Visa,
they get a little teeny sliver of every single exchange of value that goes across their network.
Visa processed more than 200 billion transactions last year. And those teeny little slivers it got on each one, oh man, did they add up. In 2008, when Visa went public, its initial public offering was the most valuable in history. So today, Visa and MasterCard dominate the credit card business. We all know them. And for credit cards, that is key. It's why they spend so much on advertising.
They're doing advertising work that none of the individual banks could really realistically do on their own, because what they're trying to do is make sure that every cardholder in the world knows that they could use that card at any merchant in the world that accepts a Visa card. And so they have to have this ubiquity, right? So that ubiquity is built in the mind of the consumer through that advertising.
In the 1960s, it wasn't a given that credit cards would actually work. Visa had to build trust with banks and with all of us. That trust is Visa's secret sauce. And it's what Visa founder Dee Hawk figured out.
Dee Hawk was a brilliant person who I think did have some profound revelations about money. I don't think he was a great philosopher of money per se, but I do think he understood practically that moving money was going to be mostly about the exchange of trusted messages between trusted partners.
When you tap your card, the merchant trusts they'll get paid. You can be in Prague, go to a club, run up a tab, and the bouncers will let you leave. All because a little plastic card in your pocket says you're good for it. On last week's show, we talked about how store clerks will ask for your email or phone number at the checkout and asked if this is something you mind.
Hi there, my name is Rita and I'm calling from Manitoba. Although I know it is frustrating when you're just trying to buy an item, I do think that there is absolutely no reason for anybody to be disrespectful to the person that is sitting in front of them, standing in front of them, earning minimum wage. That if they ask me for my email address, I just politely decline and be respectful about it. That's my two cents worth. Thank you.
I don't give them my emails. I don't even give them my whole postal code because I don't want them to know where I am. So I agree wholeheartedly that this is information that's considered confidential as far as I'm concerned, and I just don't do it. Thanks.
Hi, it's Bruce Wood calling. When people ask for my postal code, I give them the same one that Santa uses. What is it? Ho, ho, ho. H-O-H-O-H-O. And when people ask me for my phone number that I don't want to share it with, I give them the phone number for the atomic clock in Ottawa. So hopefully when they phone, they just get the time is. So thanks a lot. Love the show. Have a good day.
Bruce has the atomic clock number memorized. All right. If you hear something on the show and want to give us a call, our number is 1-866-550-COST. That's 1-866-550-2678. Or email costofliving@cbc.ca. That's all for this week. The show is based in Calgary. And thanks this week to the podcast Acquired. They asked the question, what is Visa? On a recent episode. And, you know, as it said, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. We'd also like to give a special thanks to Philip Drost and Zenith Wolf. The Cost of Living is produced by Daniel Nerman, Ellis Cho, and Jennifer Keane, with help from Caroline the Fighting Kangaroo Ferris. Our executive producer is Tracy Johnson. I'm Paul Havershrood. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.